Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Hannah Colton. Survivors of clergy sexual abuse continue to come forward in New Mexico, and many people are calling for the Catholic Church to come clean about what they knew and when. Today, we're talking about who should be held accountable for abuse and cover-up that happened years or decades ago, and what that accountability would look like. Has your family or your parish been affected by priest sexual abuse? What responses have you seen from church leadership or law enforcement? And what would you like to see? Give us a call this morning, 277-5866. We understand this conversation may bring up difficult issues for some people, and we've posted resources, including a crisis hotline number, on our webpage for today's show. You can find that at KUNM.org. You can also email in a comment for today's show at letstalk@KUNM.org. I want to welcome in the studio this morning Brad D. Hall, an attorney here in Albuquerque who's represented dozens of survivors. Dozens?
Good morning. I would say more like over 100.
Over 100.
Yeah.
Thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
Also on the line this morning, we have Dr. Jennifer Fried, a professor of psychology at the University of Oregon and a fellow at the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University. And we'll hear from Dr. Jennifer Fried in a bit here. So sexual abuse in the Catholic Church has been in the news a lot in the past few months. A Pennsylvania grand jury released hundreds of records in August, and then this fall, the New Mexico Attorney General announced a broad investigation into our three Roman Catholic dioceses. And just this week, the National U.S. Conference of Bishops was meeting in Baltimore, and they met with plans to enact some reforms around the issue of sexual abuse, but the Vatican put a stop to it. Brad, are you seeing a wave of survivors coming forward in response to all these headlines in the past few months?
Actually, probably not a wave. That might be a little bit strong of a word. I think there's been a steady cascade, you might want to call it, but a steady, you know, rollout of victims coming forward since the 90s. Since the late 80s, really. And
you've been doing this work since then?
No, I actually have not. I started doing this work specifically with regard to the church, the Catholic Church, in about 2012.
Okay. And can you give us an idea of the scope of the problem, including the cover-up in New Mexico? I know it's a hard question.
Think of how I can answer that in a sentence or two, but I think the scope of the problem in New Mexico, proportionate to its population, is huge. We have so many communities that are all Catholic, pretty much, you know, for the most part, in northern New Mexico, little towns and villages, and we have a predominantly Catholic power structure, whether it's judges, cops, principals at your junior high school or your high school. And if you're an altar boy or an altar server, if you're an altar server that's a little girl, or if you're just a child parishioner, you are extremely vulnerable in those decades to the power that was given to priests over everyone's lives.
And we are going to hear from one of those survivors soon here. I want to note also that I have requested an interview with the Archbishop of Santa Fe, John Wester, or the Victims Assistance Coordinator, Annette Klimka. Those are the leaders that, you know, really have jurisdiction over Albuquerque, Santa Fe, all of northern New Mexico for this issue. I've requested interviews with them multiple times. The Archdiocese has refused. Brad Hall, most of your clients end up settling with the church, right, for amounts of money that they can't disclose then. Why does it happen that way, generally?
Well, that's a good question. The short answer is that for most people, they're not seeking money. Almost universally, all of the clients we've represented in the last 5 or 6 years in these kind of cases are suffering from some kind of meltdown that occurs 20, 30, 40 years after the childhood sexual abuse, which is pretty typical and consistent with the social sciences that are out there. So we know that if it takes 30, 40 years before your childhood coping skills crumble, then that's when you need to come forward and get help. something happens, a word that's often used these days is trigger. I'm not sure I like that word, but it's a bit overused these days. But it kind of describes the process of people completely collapsing and ending up on the floor, literally, wondering, crying, why am I crying? I'm 50 years old. And it's because of whatever it is that caused them to suddenly have, and it's not always sudden, it could be spread over a few months or even a year or so, but for some reason they need help and they need to replace those childhood coping skills with adult coping skills because they no longer work. Like most psychologists tell me that those kind of coping skills when you're a kid work until they don't. And when they stop working, you have to do something. And literally, they're not looking for money. So to answer your question, they come looking for help. We've had therapists call us from their sessions with their patients and say, we saw your name by Googling this issue or in the media, and we think it would be therapeutic for our patient, to become a client of yours. So many times they're there for therapeutic reasons. You can marry the therapeutic interests and recovery goals that you have with litigation goals in these particular kinds of cases. And that's what we find over and over to be most satisfying to us. So
I want to go now to a guest that we have joining us by phone, a man in Las Vegas. Good morning. Can you hear me? All right, let's take a listener call from Craig in Albuquerque. Craig, you're on the air.
Hi there, can you hear me?
Yeah, what would you like to add to the conversation this morning?
Yeah, I was just I'm bothered by the fact that the church isn't holding itself to the same standard that it has held its parishioners to pretty much forever, as far as the idea of confession. In order to receive confession for, any kind of sin, you have to fully, state what you did. And the church is still not doing that. It's a basic tenet of the church, but yet in this process, they want to, be absolved of their sins and move on before they've fully acknowledged it. And I think that's not beneficial to the victims, and it's hypocritical of the church.
Craig, do you belong to a parish here in New Mexico, or what's your experience with the Catholic Church?
I'm not affiliated with any specific religion.
Okay, thank you for calling in this morning. Let's go now to a man joining us from Las Vegas by phone. He's identified as John Doe in a lawsuit that you filed against the church. Good morning.
Good morning.
Tell us a bit about yourself. We've agreed to not use your name at your request because, not everyone in your life knows about what you've experienced. But tell us a bit about yourself and your upbringing.
I grew up in Las Vegas, very strong Catholic community. My family was extremely involved in the church. My grandmother worked for the church. My mom is and was a Eucharistic minister. We had a choir in the church, so we were at church a couple times a week all through my childhood.
So very, very involved in the church. And you're a survivor of sexual abuse by a priest, is that right?
That's correct.
Can you tell us a little bit about the circumstances of that? How old were you? Where did it happen?
I was 13 years old, and I had just, I'm not sure if out of laziness or what it was, but I didn't want to get confirmed. And because I didn't want to go through my confirmation, my parents weren't very happy with that. I'm not exactly sure how they knew Sabine. At the time, I know he had a radio show in Las Vegas. He did the rosary on the radio or something like that. His mom had a house or still has a house here in Las Vegas.
And so this is Sabine Griego is the name of the priest.
Griego.
I should mention who has denied these allegations, just for the record, but please continue.
So anyway, they sent me to go see Sabine, and we talked for a long time about a variety of issues. He gave me a glass of wine, and now that I'm older, I recognize that he must have put something in my wine about, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes, I would guess, passed after I had maybe half a glass of wine. I woke up with him performing oral sex on me.
And you were a teenager, right? So how did this affect your life moving forward and your faith and your relationships? I mean, what was the impact?
It's kind of hard to give a really brief answer on that, but it wrecks you completely, you know, because my mom sent me to go see him, it caused issues and trust issues between us. You know, then you're brought up to think that the Catholic Church is infallible, you know, that they make no mistakes, that it's a perfect institution, they're God on earth. And then something like that happens and it completely shakes your foundation and everything you believe in and everything you trust. And it really messed me up for a long time, you know. It's funny, going back to what Brad said, I was actually in therapy as an older man. I'm in my 50s now. I was in my 40s. I was in therapy, having this discussion with my therapist as far as what had taken place with Sabine. Came home that afternoon, and there was an article on Facebook in regard to Sabine. Brad's name was mentioned in there, and I hadn't actually talked to my therapist about Sabine yet. I had talked to her about issues with my mom, me not being able to develop trusting relationships with anyone because I didn't trust anyone. So we were kind of working on that, and it blew me away. When Brad talks about a seminal moment where truly is like getting struck by a bolt of lightning, that's exactly what happened to me. So in talking to my therapist more about that, she's the one who encouraged me to go and see Brad, kind of try to get some closure with that. So it helped in a way, but the scars never heal. You know, the pain never goes away. I was talking to you this morning. Since I talked to you day before yesterday, I haven't slept at all. I've been having nightmares again. It's one of these things that, and I speak only for myself. I can't speak for anybody else that's gone through it, but it's affecting me all my life and will continue to affect me till the day I die.
I want to thank you so much for sharing. I know this is a really difficult topic, and I appreciate you being so open with us. You said like this is, it's still affecting you to this day. What motivates you to speak openly like this about it?
You know, I just want other people to know, because I know there's other people that are out there that haven't seen a therapist, that haven't discussed this, that haven't disclosed this to anybody. And I'm hoping that by me doing it, it gives them the strength to at least disclose and to talk to somebody about it, because it's important. You know, even though I don't feel whole, I feel better having had discussions with a therapist and having had discussions about this with some of my best friends, just kind of getting it out in the open and understanding that it's not our fault, meaning that we didn't do anything wrong. And I think that was the biggest thing for me, as I held all this shame for so many years, and I felt bad about myself. And if I can help another survivor realize that they have nothing to do with it and to seek help and to get help and things can get better, that's why I agreed to get on the radio today.
We do have resources also posted on our website if this conversation is stirring up strong emotions for anyone listening today. That's at KUNM.org, and you can check out the show page for this show this morning. We need to go to a quick break. The number to call in this morning is 277-5866, and those phone lines are open. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. We'll be back in a minute.
The law firm of Rothstein Donatelli is committed to supporting KUNM. Since 1976, the firm has litigated Native American law, criminal defense, wrongful death, and civil rights in New Mexico and nationwide. Info at rothsteinlaw.com.
Program support provided by Fantang Asian Wok, featuring coffee chicken, organic ingredients, extensive gluten-free menu, and vegetarian and vegan options. Fantang Asian Wok, on the corner of Central and Carlisle, on the web at fan-tang.com.
Between concerts at the Music at Menlo Festival, cellist Keith Robinson says there is some serious ping pong.
You know, I'm one of the most competitive people you'll ever meet, but the very first year I got here, I saw I was overmatched.
Music and ping pong at Menlo on the next Performance Today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
This is Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Hannah Colton. Our focus today is priest sexual abuse in the New Mexico Catholic Church. Call in now. Are you a practicing or non-practicing Catholic? How has sexual abuse within the church affected your family or community? Are church leaders saying or doing enough to make things right? 277-KUNM is the number to call. That's 277-5866. We're also on Twitter, and you can use the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. I have in the studio this morning Brad D. Hall, an attorney for many victims here in Albuquerque. Also on the line is a survivor of priest sexual abuse in Las Vegas, New Mexico, and we heard his story, and we'll be checking in throughout the show with him. Brad, just last week, the Diocese of Las Cruces took a big step in publishing a list of 28 clergy they say are credibly accused of sexual misconduct. And I want to note that as journalists, we are skeptical of these lists, right? Because the church doesn't tell the public exactly how they're making those judgments. They just say, you know, we believe these men have been credibly accused. But how important are these disclosures to your clients and to your cases?
I think they're important to the potential clients. It's not all about just the people I've represented, but it's all about the survivors out there. The John Doe on the line used the word survivor, and it's a good word because, unfortunately, I've learned a lot in the last 5 years about those who did not survive. There's an awful lot of late teens, early 20s suicides in all these towns that we know from the litigation process probably were abused. So to answer your question, though, the credibly accused lists are determined by each diocese with a review of their own records. In the Archdiocese of Santa Fe, they had 44 people on the list a few years ago. The more litigation and the more discovery and the more we looked at things, the more that list evolved until now it's 79. So I'm expecting similar thing to happen in Las Cruces in terms of adding people to that list. I think it's important to survivors out there to see the church at least taking some step, a small step forward. So it's easy for me to, criticize, I guess, and look as like an armchair quarterback at what the church does and at the pace at which it does things. But at least it's a step in the right direction. That's what I would describe it as. Anything that's a step towards more transparency has got to be viewed as good from an institutional point of view.
Sure. And I think, you know, a big part of the discussion today is just acknowledging the fact that the church is not a public institution and we can't file, you know, a public records request to get the information that we think should be public. And so it's really, we really depend on the institution to take these steps. I want to bring into the conversation Dr. Jennifer Fried, a professor of psychology at the University of Oregon and a fellow at the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University. She's joining us on the phone. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Jennifer. So you've studied how the way institutions respond when their members report abuse makes a big difference in survivors' experience of trauma. I mean, tell us about that. You've used this term institutional betrayal.
Yes, absolutely. I can see its relevance already this morning in the discussions. So for a long time, my lab at the University of Oregon has been studying the impact of traumas on people, and particularly what we call betrayal traumas, which is typically some form of abuse perpetrated by somebody that the victim trusts and depends upon. So a lot of clergy abuse is a betrayal trauma. And more recently, in the last 10 years, we have focused increasingly on the role of institutions in the harm and potential healing from this sort of experience. And what we've seen is that when institutions respond poorly, it's associated with more harm than when the institution doesn't respond poorly, even controlling for, even holding constant the interpersonal experience. So that means if somebody gets abused in an institutional context by, say, a clergy member, that's bad. On average, that's bad. But on average, it's even worse if the institution responds poorly. And you've probably heard people say, like, people might come back from a military service and report they were sexually assaulted in the context of the military and say, that was really bad. The sexual assault was really bad. But what was even worse was how the military responded when I tried to get some assistance for this terrible experience.
And what is, you said the harm can become worse. What harm are you talking about? Like, what effects for survivors?
Yes. So this research is relatively new. We've been doing it from about the year 2010. My primary collaborator, Carly Smith, is now an assistant professor at Penn State, but now many others have joined this effort. And so far we have measured a number of things, but I would just want to say there's more to measure. But we've seen harm associated with institutional betrayal in both the psychological and the physical and actually the and behavioral domain. So for instance, higher symptoms of anxiety, higher symptoms of depression, higher symptoms of PTSD when there is institutional betrayal compared to when there's not. And this is comparing for people who have been victimized. And then we've also seen physical symptoms. So more complaints about how people's, you know, bodies are functioning. And then researchers in another lab found something I think is particularly alarming. They did look at military sexual trauma survivors, and they found that those with institutional betrayal experiences were also more likely to attempt suicide. And you know, that's a really sobering thing to think about, because really it suggests that institutional betrayal can be a life or death matter for people.
Right, which really echoes and confirms what we heard from Brad just now. I want to go to the phone line. Frank Lee is on the phone from Albuquerque. Frank, good morning. What would you like to add?
Oh, yes. We keep hearing about the Catholic Church. And it's not only in the Catholic Church. I know in my personal experiences, I was in a Protestant, Presbyterian-backed, prestigious New Jersey college preparatory all boys boarding school, and these incidents, this happened to me, was a gang rape, I guess you would call it, and eventually ended up with me, the victim, being expelled from the school and paying for it for the rest of my life. My life went to hell in a handbasket, I guess. But it wasn't a Catholic school. It was just another. It was a Protestant school. What's the religion got to do with it? There are these people. They're in this world. They prey on young people, and that's. I can't continue. Thank you for listening.
Frank, I want to thank you so much for sharing that personal story with us today. I know that can't be easy. Thank you so much for calling in. Sarah in Albuquerque, you are on the air. Good morning,
Sarah. Hi, am I on?
Yeah. What would you like to add?
I just wanted to mention that I heard from somebody that the Catholic Church has a lot of political enemies, because they take a lot of political stance. about many different issues, and I think I have sympathy for these accusations. I'm sure that they were molested and abused, but the media, they blow it out of proportions because, you know, they have a lot of enemies. For example, like the Pope was all for clean air and clean environment, and he set an example by driving a fuel-efficient car. And they're really about, like, the petroleum oil companies might be after them. That's one enemy. And then they're always about helping and feeding the poor. And most of the people, they would prefer, like, the poor people to just starve to death. You know, when they raise up an issue, that means more food stamps, medical care, and help for the poor, and the government has to take responsibilities. So, and I think also, are they after the war in the Middle East? It's another political stance. They want to stop the war of unnecessary killing. And the war weapons,
all right, Sarah, I have to pause you there. We do have other callers on the line. Thank you so much for calling in. I want to mention also, again, if this conversation is bringing up difficult things for anyone, I want to point you to the New Mexico Warm Line, 1-855-NM-CRISIS. And we have a bunch of other resources on our webpage for this show on KUNM.org. Let's take one more. Actually, I want to put that question to our guests. Brad, what do you think about that idea that there's some exaggeration or politicization of this issue with the Catholic Church?
I don't think it matches up with my experience of having spent maybe 1,000 hours in the last 5 or 6 years with these men and women. Basically, when we're not talking about a minimized version of molestation or some word like that. Usually we're talking about rape. If you're talking about a 10-year-old being raped 200 times for 2 or 3 years, plied with alcohol, and put into a situation where no one is going to believe him because the person in power happens to be a priest. It could be a Presbyterian at an all-boys school. Sure. And anybody in a position of power. However, with the Catholics, things got so involved, I guess, over the decades that as things unfolded over time, that it's like Jennifer was talking about, the institution itself failed to respond. And when it failed to respond year after year, it started realizing that pedophiles in its midst were numerous and were among those who were overseeing the problem. And so the protection of other priests by other pedophiles made a system explode on the population in Boston and California and in Albuquerque and New Mexico, Louisiana, globally, nationally. So you're talking about thousands of children. We're talking about rape. We're not talking about molestation, whatever that means. So I don't think anybody is coming forward decades later to try to get some kind of closure and accountability and heal so that they can continue to live in some productive way as either a parent or a grandparent or whatever they are by that time. They're not doing that in order to cast aspersions on some political view somebody has in Rome or somewhere.
If you're listening in, what do you think? What responsibility does the church have today for clergy abuse that happened perhaps long ago? Do the good things that the church does in the world, the charity, the taking care of people, does that outweigh the bad? What do you think? The number to call in is 277-5866. You can also tweet the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. Let's take another call. Paul is on the line from Santa Fe. Paul, good morning.
Good morning. I think that I work at Rothstein Donatelli, know Brad well. We're also working on some of these cases. And I think the underlying elephant in the room that has been alluded to by some of your guests and the folks on the phone is the effort that the church has gone through over decades to maintain silence and the way that they've abused the system and that they now have been allowed to continue hiding the pain and harm they've caused to the overall community. And that even though the church itself seems incapable of shame, some of your callers have alluded to the shame that they felt as survivors, and this can be crippling. And the church uses this and the threat of them being outed to their families and communities and in a way to kind of force settlements and quiet settlements at that. And I think that's the reason that so many of these lawsuits have been settled confidentially, and that the church has managed to go so long without accounting for the damage it's done or anything approaching full disclosure. And I think it's important to remember that not only do the individual survivors need an opportunity to heal, but our entire community needs that opportunity. And that is never going to be done until the full breadth of what occurred is really exposed. And whether that can be accomplished by lawsuits, an extension of the statute of limitations, the grand jury, or just simply the Catholic Church finally living up to its own teachings, one way or another, it has to happen. And I think it is important to remember that we as a community, at some point, we need to put our foot down and just insist that this silence end.
Thanks so much for that call, Paul. I want to put this to our survivor of priest abuse who is on the line as a guest from Las Vegas this morning. What do you think? I mean, in your experience, what more should the church be doing either to provide transparency or support or justice? I mean, what do you want to happen?
I think simply them acknowledging that they've done wrong and that they knew that wrongdoing has been going on for so long. You know, Sarah, I think was her name. She has a complete, this has nothing to do with politics. This has nothing to do with anything. I think people in New Mexico, if they understood how long this has been going on, how many people have known that it's been going on for this long and that it continues to go on, they would be blown away. And the attorney that was just on is absolutely correct. The church does it to maintain power and control. I absolutely wanted my case to go to trial. I wanted the world kind of to know about everything that had gone on, but it's such a difficult process, and the church makes it even that much harder, and they make you relive it over and over and over and over again to a point where it simply just wears you down and wears you out, and you don't want to continue with it anymore. And I think the church knows that they're doing that, and such is the reason that it's never been brought into the light. And I think once that happens, and I hope it does, I think people will be astounded by the breadth and depth of the scandal.
Thank you for sharing that. Let's go to the phone line. Ruben is calling from Albuquerque. Ruben, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning, Hannah. It's good to speak with you again.
Yeah.
And Brad, too. Brad, thank you so much for all your efforts in bringing this case to, with transparency of what happened in our home.
Yeah, what would you like to add to the conversation this morning?
I would like to say this, especially to all Catholics. I'm a Catholic. And by the way, I did say a rosary and a Divine Mercy for both you and Brad, because I think that your efforts and what you're doing in this is mountainous. You need to, you need to bring this right out so that we can make this world a better place to live in. What I want to say is that I had a pedophile priest in my home for 7 months, and you know about it, Hannah, because you were right on the case.
That's right. I reported on this story, and folks can go to our website to learn
That's
more.
That's right. Yep. Yes. Father Jerome P. Coyle. And the problem is that he was not on any sexual abuse list. He was moved from Sioux City, Iowa, to Albuquerque, to Santa Fe, to the Santa Fe Archdiocese, seeking treatment 32 years ago. This man was a pedophile of over 50 children. And he ended up in my home, a family, where we have children, 13, 15, and 17. And that's exactly the age that this man perpetrated. Now, we don't realize it as Catholics, but our monies that we donate to the Catholic Church, to the men, go to pedophilia, because this man was supported. He was supported here in Albuquerque. And they even upped his monies when he started coming into our home. Well, we got a letter stating that he was a pedophile that we did not know about. And when we found out, my wife and I, we asked him, we said, Jerry, can you promise us that you will not harm our boy who was right down the hall from him? He was 10 steps away, and he said, no. He couldn't promise. These men are out there, and it's because of our good monies that we donate to the Catholic Church. And I've done it myself. I've given in huge amounts, large amounts, thousands of dollars to these men. The only way that you can be assured that your blood money, that your donations don't become blood money, is by going and if you want to fix their roof, fix it personally. Go to a contractor and have it fixed. Go and give to a Catholic school if you want to do it that way. But make sure you're giving. Your monies are not being turned into blood money because that's a sin.
All right. Thank you so much, Ruben. Do you agree? Do you disagree? Should parishioners stop giving their money to the Catholic Church? You can call in this morning, 277-5866. Let's go to another caller in Santa Fe, a caller who'd like to remain anonymous. You are on the air. What would you like to add?
Good morning.
Good morning. What's your comment this morning? You're on the air.
My comment is just that I feel like just historically that the Catholic Church has always represented has been the oppressor's religion, and that it was forced from the beginning, and everything that we're experiencing in our culture and society today is just a side effect or is what that religion has produced. And it's a pretty strong testament to actually what kind of organization that is. And I feel like that all those organizations should just step down from any kind of power or authority and any kind of revenue or money that has been generated, or real estate or influence, should just be dispersed to the community, and they should walk away from what they've built. And if they want to express their religion in however they want to do it, then they should do it personally and not try to enforce the ideology that you need to go through an organization or any man to get in touch with spirit or God. It's a very personal thing, and no one should be forced to do it or told how to do it. So being that they have historically had power and control with the colonizers, that they need to walk away, and maybe they should just go back to where they came from and have their religion and do whatever that they want their way, and not inflict these terrible things into communities and societies.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that call. We do need to go to a break. The number to call in, 277-5866. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. We'll be back in a minute.
Rock Your Mox is a movement that started in celebration of indigenous identity and culture. Every year, Native people show off their traditional footwear, like moccasins and mukluks, for a day, and for some, a whole week. Each pair of moccasins tells a traditional and personal Native story. We'll rock your mox on the next Native America Calling.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, President Trump says he wants to get rid of birthright citizenship guaranteed by the 14th Amendment. We looked at a country that actually took it away to see what happens. That's next time on Latino USA.
That's Latino USA, Monday mornings at 8 a.m. on KUNM.
You're listening to Let's Talk New Mexico on KUNM. I'm Hannah Colton. We're talking about clergy sexual abuse and how individuals and communities can begin to heal from this kind of betrayal. If you belong to a Catholic community in New Mexico, what are you hearing from church leaders about the sexual abuse crisis? Is the topic even on the table? And are law enforcement and state lawmakers doing enough to hold perpetrators accountable? You can tweet a comment at us using the hashtag #LetsTalkNM or email letstalk@kunm.org. Kevin is on the line in Albuquerque. Kevin, good morning. What would you like to add to the show this morning?
Good morning. Yeah, I would like to just say yes. You know, it did happen. I was a young man up in Jemez in the 70s, and you know, I had an attempted molestation. And you know, over the years, I've had to realize that I was abused, and I just, you know, about 30 years ago, Bruce Pasternak got my name, and it was just kind of a thing where it made me realize that probably some of my friends happened to, because I'm not sure where he got my name. I have talked to somebody at Bruce Hall's firm, and he gave me good advice. And you know, just, I know I've talked to the DA recently, just with the news. It's the type of thing where I can't identify the person. So every time somebody comes up, like the guy recently that they brought back to the States, you know, if they have glasses, you know, it's the type of thing where, hey, you know, could have been the guy, you know, so I don't know. I just wanted to say it did happen, and it isn't a conspiracy as a, you know, that brings up, you know, that people bring up.
Thank you so much for sharing that story. I know that's not easy. With that experience, what do you think needs to change as far as law enforcement response or the church itself? Any thoughts, Kevin?
I'm totally for a grand jury. You know, I hope the DA does that, at least gets that going in our state. And then just more, you know, more, you know, get force the Catholic Church to bring out more, you know, more names.
More transparency. Thank you so much. And I want to remind everyone, we have a bunch of resources listed on our post for this show online at KUNM.org, including resources for survivors of rape and sexual assault. I want to bring into the conversation now Elizabeth Terrell, a licensed clinical counselor in Gallup and the Victims Assistance Coordinator for the Diocese of Gallup. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. So tell us a bit about what your work involves with the diocese there.
Yeah, absolutely. So I am the first point of contact for survivors or for people who have felt really victimized in any way by the church. They can call me anytime, 24/7, and I respond to them, and I try to make sure that, you know, if something needs to be investigated, that starts immediately, or if something needs to be addressed with them personally, or if they need a referral for counseling or other services, that I make sure that that happens, including like legal services. So if they're looking into wanting to file suit against the church or anything like that, then I also refer them to other like attorneys and stuff who have previously represented survivors against our diocese. So, I mean, that's the majority of my job. And then also just operating as a mental health consultant to the diocese so that they can really understand the long-term effects of trauma, especially from things like clergy abuse and the cover-up that happens afterwards, because I do think that you know, complicates the trauma even further. And so that's my main position.
And so the Diocese of Gallup is in a different situation than the other two in Santa Fe and in Las Cruces, because the Gallup Diocese declared bankruptcy in 2013 in response to a large number of lawsuits it was facing from survivors of sexual abuse. Can you just describe what that was and how the diocese came to a settlement agreement briefly?
Yeah, so it became clear after 2002 when all the abuse scandal kind of broke open nationwide, right? It became clear that we were having all of these very credible allegations of sexual abuse and that we weren't quite sure how to manage the multiple lawsuits and potential settlements and things like that. So the Diocese of Gallup is one of the poorest dioceses in the country, right? We're a mission diocese. So financially, we weren't going to be able to settle like with people or provide any sort of compensation, or even like counseling services would have been difficult for us to pay for. And so we filed Chapter 11 so that we bankruptcy, right, to make sure that we could compensate the survivors in the way that they needed to be compensated for what the horrible things that had happened to them. And so that's why we filed for Chapter 11. It was mostly just so that we could actually have some sort of means of making amends for the horrible mistakes that the Catholic Church made.
Another way the Diocese of Gallup is somewhat different is there are the majority of parishes there are in remote and rural areas, many on the Navajo Nation. There are significant barriers for victim survivors to report misconduct and get outside help. That's, you know, still the case geographically, of course. How has the diocese changed the way it operates to prevent that from happening again?
Right. So one of the things which was included in our Chapter 11 lawsuit is we posted you know, our commitment to safe environment in every parish, along with my name and phone number. And we post that in English, Navajo, and Spanish in every parish. We also reach out. So the bishop has done healing masses at every parish where a potential, like, where an abuser would have served. So even if we haven't had an allegation from that parish, if the abuser served in the parish, the bishop did a healing mass in the parish where he went and publicly apologized to all potential victims or survivors. And in doing that, he also offered himself up afterwards to talk with anybody who wanted to speak to him alone in order to just be available to them. But the other thing is we've also published. So when we published our credibly accused list and when we filed Chapter 11 and all of those things, we've tried to also publish in the media my phone number with, like, every response that we have to the sexual abuse crisis. So if somebody is not comfortable, which is totally understandable, they might not want to go into a Catholic church. They might not have anything to do with the church anymore. So we try to also just keep it very public in the media. It's also located on our website. I believe it's also on the USCCB website so that people can find access to my phone number. And once they call me, then I can give them access to all the services that we can provide. Obviously, it's difficult to do mental health services in some of the more rural areas. But so far, we've managed to find counseling agencies that could serve in the right capacity.
All right. I want to get to a few listener calls. We still have people on the line. Mary in Santa Fe, you are on the air. Good morning.
Hi. I grew up in New York, and when I was discussing my own sexual abuse incidents with my mom, she said, when I was 12, so she was born in 1926, so, you know, I'm sure it's been going on a long time, but she was sent to the church at 12 years old to get, like, a mass card or something on a Saturday. And she was molested by a priest at 12 years old. She was developing early. And I said, did you tell your mom? She said, no. I said, she would have believed the priest. And then it repeated when she was married. And my father had a friend who was a priest who also abused her. And she didn't get into the real details. But again, it was, did you tell my dad? And she said, no, he would have believed the priest. You know, this isn't as severe as some, you know, cases out there, but just that whole hierarchy and respect and not questioning, I'm happy to see that is crumbling. and I'm just happy for people that they can speak out now and get the support they need.
Mary, thank you so much for calling in and sharing that. I appreciate you being open about that. Let's go to Mooney in Albuquerque. Thanks for calling. What would you like to add?
Hi, I actually was calling to readdress or to talk about something. A gentleman from Santa Fe called, maybe four or five callers back, talking about the fact that the Catholic Church arrived in the New World as a tool of the oppressor. And I realize this is kind of outside of the scope of today's discussion, but it's this, all of this is sort of an extension of the fact that it was brought as a tool to be used to undermine already existing belief systems. And when it's introduced in that way, I mean, this is kind of the logical outcome to some extent. I'm sure I had much more organized things to say, but I'll leave it at that.
So, Mooney, if people want to learn more about that perspective and you know, talk with other people to that effect, are there resources or a group they could get involved in?
Gosh.
Sorry to put you on the spot.
That's all right. No, I really wish, I feel like I should have a good answer to that. I don't. I'm sure that there are. I mean, I think really history, that's really the colonial expansion of Spain and Portugal are really the only places to look.
All right. We certainly invite you to comment on our Facebook page, Twitter, email letstalk@kunm.org. Thank you so much for that call. Let's go to Mary in Albuquerque. Mary, you're on the air.
Morning. I wanted to share my observation over the years. I remember hearing Dr. Victor Lecerda at a seminar on New Mexico's teen pregnancy rate, that we have a lot of kids who are taught.
I'm so sorry, Mary. We're going to have to pause you there. The connection is really hard. Thanks so much for calling. Let's take one more call this hour. Rosemary in Placitas. What would you like to add?
Yes, I'm calling from Placitas, and I went to Catholic schools 13 years and know a lot about the faith and morals and doctrine. Celibacy is not a matter of faith, moral, and doctrine. It's actually historically came upon because of financial reasons in the 11th and the 12th centuries. The church became concerned that the wives of these wealthy bishops and what have you, cardinals, were going to inherit cathedrals.
See, it cuts off.
So they said, well, we got a solution. We'll interject celibacy so the women can't inherit anything. So, I mean, if this is something celibacy we need to look at. All the other Christian churches, they don't have celibacy. The Pope's already addressed this. 3 weeks ago, there was an article in the Journal that said the Pope's looking into it. There's thousands of priests all over the world that are good priests that left to marry women that they love. So I think this is something the church needs to look hard at, and all of us. So.
All right. Thank you so much, Rosemary, for your call and comment about celibacy. We are coming to the end of the hour. I want to take it to our guest, Dr. Jennifer Fried, for last thoughts. What can an institution like the church do to make things better? You call it institutional courage. What are a couple of examples quickly?
Absolutely. So one of the things in institutional courage that's so important is to gather accurate data about what's really going on and making that available in a transparent way. So this is often done through, and best done through, anonymous surveys
just
that are scientifically sound.
Just about 10 seconds left, sorry.
Okay, and it can really turn things around, the honesty and the transparency and the knowledge.
And we'll post more resources about institutional betrayal and courage on our website. That's all the time we have. Thank you to all of our guests. We heard from several survivors who called in, our one survivor preferred not to share his name. Thank you so much to him. You can find a list of resources for sexual abuse survivors on our website, kunm.org. Thank you to Elizabeth Terrell, Dr. Jennifer Fried, and Brad D. Hall. You can comment on our Facebook page to continue the conversation. If you missed part of today's show, you can also listen on our website. Our engineer is Marino Spencer. Bryce Dix screened your calls. Madison Spratto live tweeted the show. Elaine Baumgartner executive produced. I'm Hannah Colton.